Okay, so I finish up to verse number, I think verse number four. I'll read verse number five. Start with verse number five again. Whenever someone out of envy does me wrong by attacking or belittling me, I will take defeat upon myself and give the victory to others. And then in Tibetan, Dala Shinji Tadogi, Shikur Laso Miripe, Chungarangi Lemba, Yega Shinlam Beaver Show. So the commentary goes like, learning to accept loss and defeat for ourselves and offering gain and victory to others is the very foundation of the Bodhisattva practice. Although it may appear at the worldly level that we suffer loss by way of this practice, ultimately the practitioner receives the greatest benefit of spiritual wealth and virtue. In learning to accept harsh or unjust treatment, we should not allow ourselves to react with anger, behave in the same non-virtuous ways in return, or to abandon others because of their actions towards us. This is the essence of accepting defeat and offering the victory, and the accomplishment of supreme patience and kindness. By accepting defeat and offering the victory to others with the pure motivation of heartfelt compassion, we destroy the ignorance of our self-cherishing at its very roots. So that is verse number five. And then verse number six reads, even when someone I have helped or in whom I have placed great hopes mistreats me very unjustly, I will view that person as a true spiritual teacher. In Tibetan it reads, Kangla dagi penta pe rewa chewa kangshi ki hindu mirik nwe jena shenyen tambar tabar shio. The commentary reads, when we are kind to people, helping them, giving them our trust and hope, we naturally expect to be treated kindly in return. When people repay our kindness and trust by harming us or treating us in hurtful ways, we often react with anger, hurt, or disappointment. After such an experience, we may find it difficult to give them our love and respect. This type of ordinary love is conditional and impure. As practitioners, we want to embrace a situation such as this with skillful wisdom, compassion, and unconditional love. Therefore, it is essential that we have a way to transform these difficult experiences into the actual path to enlightenment. To accomplish this, we learn to see a person who harms us or treats us in hurtful ways as our precious teacher. This person becomes our precious teacher because of the priceless Dharma lessons we receive. Through their kindness, we also receive the ripening and purification of our own negative karma, which is the inevitable result of our having done a similar thing to someone in the past. In this way, we can see how even our worst enemies can be our greatest benefactors and precious teachers. And then this is verse number seven, right? Mm-hmm. In brief, directly or indirectly, I will offer help and happiness to all my mothers and secretly take upon myself all their hurt and suffering. Dorna ngwe dang gyub, dorna ngwe sum gyubayi, pende manam kuin lam bul, mai nwe dang dungel kuin, Samaya Dala Lembrasho. This verse refers to the essence of Tonglin practice, giving and taking. We are to offer directly and indirectly our help, happiness, benefit, skills, and resources in loving service to all beings who certainly, at some time in the past, have been our own mothers. In Tonglin practice, with strong compassion, we visualize taking on the obstacles, problems, illnesses, and suffering of others. We then visualize giving them all our happiness, comfort, love, virtue, prosperity, and great insights. In this verse, the word secretly suggests this particular practice of compassion may not be suitable or may be too difficult for beginning practitioners. It also means that this practice should be done discreetly and not openly displayed or spoken about so as to gain praise or recognition. So I think maybe Geshe-la will elaborate on it later on much more. But this is the, Tonglin practice is one of the most important practices that the so-called Gautama teachings, teachers have been practicing in Tibet, and even now. The whole lineage has continued until now. And so as the word giving and taking, so giving here means giving all my, all my fortune, my blessings, my positive deeds, and then the results, whatever I have accomplished or whatever I have accumulated, to all sentient beings. And then taking means taking their suffering, their misfortune, their negativities, their misdeeds, all to myself. So there's a specific, of course, there are specific techniques how to meditate on this, especially on this practice itself, which we will discuss later. Maybe Geshe-la will tell about it later. But this is what Tonglin means, literally. Tongwa means just give. And Lemba means just take in. So I give all my, I give out all my positive karma and their effects, and then all the precious accomplishments or prosperities, whatever I have, whatever normally which you regard as something healthy and wealthy, and which we normally in the world will we all aspire to achieve. So I just give all that to all sentient beings, to my all mother sentient beings, and then instead take their misfortunes, the effects of their misdeeds, the suffering that they undergo because of their misdeeds, to myself. Okay, that is the essence of the practice. And the last verse is, the last verse is, I will learn to keep all these practices untainted by thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. May I recognize all things as like illusions, and without attachment gain freedom from bondage. And then the Tibetan verse is, The commentary goes like this. It is essential that our spiritual practice not be defiled or stained by the eight worldly concerns. For example, engaging in these practices hoping to be recognized or praised as an excellent Dharma practitioner is not the right motivation. Nor should we practice with expectations of gaining something special or pleasurable for ourselves. Our motivation for practice must not become polluted or obscured by worldly concerns, and attachment. The motivation is to act exclusively and compassionately for the benefit of all, for the benefit of other beings. Our mind training practice must also be unified with our direct perception of ultimate truth or emptiness. As we gain realization of ultimate truth, we understand the empty, illusory, and impermanent nature of all existing things. With this realization, grasping or clinging to external appearances or being deceived by them diminishes, and we gain liberation from the bondage of attachment and mistaken views of reality. So the so-called eight worldly concerns are gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, and then fame and dishonor. So those are the eight worldly concerns. And then the goal here is that whatever practice that I have done in my bodhisattva path, I should never be concerned with all these eight worldly concerns. My motivation should be devoid of all these eight worldly concerns. Whatever practice I do, it should be totally totally dedicated to the goal of enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings and nothing else. No other motivation except benefiting, practice whatever I practice to reach the enlightened state for the sake of all sentient beings. That is the purity of the motivation that we are supposed to maintain in it while we practice the Bodhisattva path. If I just practice in order to gain something, or to avoid loss, or to gain pleasure, and then avoid pain, or to get some praise and then avoid blame, or to get some fame and avoid dishonor, then my practice becomes contaminated or impure. It will not be the right practice. It will not be the real bodhisattva practice, because it's all contaminated with all these different motivations, so-called worldly motivations. And therefore, I will not be really progressing on my path to the enlightened state. Returning back to lower states because of my impure motivation. So that is the whole goal, you know. So in this, especially the last practice is the, and then especially the understanding of emptiness is very, very important in the last stage, because that is what really purifies all our, ultimately ultimate purifier of all the negative emotions, because the root of all the negative emotions comes from, or you can say it emerges from, clinging to the self, which ultimately doesn't exist, you know. Once you are able to analyze and see for yourself that the so-called self, the personal self, or the self in the phenomena, does not exist, truly exist, then the corresponding emotions, the negative emotions, will not arise, and as a result, then you will not be committing the actions, you know, which arise from these, because these negative emotions really just propel us to do all the negative actions. And then once you do the negative actions, then all the results, all the suffering all the suffering is generated, you know, automatically, without choice. That's the law of karma, you know. I mean, as long as you commit action, you know, it has its consequences without any choice for us. Hence, if we really want to ultimately purify all the negative actions and therefore wants to get liberated from samsara existence, then one has to understand shunyata or the so-called emptiness. And then, of course, there will be lots of teachings or techniques to practice that. But the essence is just to, the summation is just to understand the selflessness of person as well as the selflessness of the phenomena, that nothing exists in the universe on its own, you know. There's nothing that exists independently on its own, or nothing exists independently as well as intrinsically on its own. Everything arises and everything exists dependently upon something else. So whatever events or whatever happens in this universe happens because of so many factors, so many causes, conditions. So that's the essence of the idea of selflessness of person or selflessness of phenomena. And once you gain insight slowly into this kind of understanding, then the propensity or the intensity of the negative emotions also diminish slowly. And once you totally understand it inside out, then of course all the negative emotions that arise are totally extinguished or annihilated. And then that is the state of liberation or nirvana, you know, so-called nirvana. So this is in very short form, you know, the practice of the eight verses by Geshe Langri Thangpa. And now we can discuss more about it with two questions and answers maybe. Or Isla might be having some other teachings.
So any questions? Any comments? Yes.
I wanted to ask, when we were talking about cherishing others as supreme or cherishing ill-tempered people, does that cherishing provide some beneficial karma for them, either in this life or in their next?
You mean
when we cherish someone, does it affect them? Am I providing them through that cherishing some positive karma for them?
Yeah, my personal idea or answer is I'm not so qualified to answer because these are really deep questions about karma and their results, you know. And in Buddhism, the karma and the results of karma are very, very complicated topic. And I'm not really so sure about. But in general, you know, what really helps is that if I cherish someone who is doing evil, you know, it doesn't mean, as I said before, I'm not condoning his actions, you know, but I'm just wishing him all the best so that in future he doesn't suffer. Because this very act that he has done so far has enormous negative consequences for him to suffer in the future, you know. So I'm even more concerned about his welfare, about his well-being, you know. So if possible, I'll try my best not to allow him to continue in that state, that action, you know. If I'm capable or if I have the capacity to do anything that I can to intervene, I'll do my best. But if not, but still I just pray and I'll never get angered. I'll never put myself in negative states because it doesn't help, you know. I mean, it will be even more bad karma for me also if I just become angry because of his evil acts, you know. Then I'm also, I mean, returning myself to lower states. So
maybe becoming ourselves as
a
hinder.
Yeah, yeah. There's more tendency for me to go to lower states also. So that is, as far as I'm concerned, that is how I understand it, you know. But it is, in general, very complicated. You know, even Buddha has said in his teachings that the karma, the law of karma and the consequences of karma are extremely complicated. So in general, people are not recommended to you know, say with certainty, with all the conviction and certainty about it, because it's so complicated. Only Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have the kind of, you know, the insight or the knowledge to say authoritatively on the karma, the karma and its consequences. You know, we as ordinary persons are, I mean, it's beyond our capacity to make comments or to decide with certainty that this karma will affect this in this way. It's very complicated because there are so many factors, so many variables involved. You know, that's why I said, you know, who produced Hitler in the first place? Is it just by he himself came on the scene, you know, out of nowhere? Or is the German people, you know, alone produce it? Or is the whole European continent produce it? Or is the whole world responsible for him, or who, you know? So if we analyze from that perspective, it's very difficult to point, you know, yes, he is the one who was produced by one single factor. Yeah, there will be innumerable factors for his rise to power and then perish, for his fall down also in upon power.
So that kind of goes back to what you were talking about, at least with by cherishing,
right,
not adding more negativity.
Yeah. Right, exactly, yeah,
At least I know that much.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That I'm not adding more negativity or
yes.
ill
yes, yes.
Into the world.
Yeah,
so
if right.
By cherishing them.
Right, that because, we just don't say he's the hero. Of course, we should more of his kind. Never like that, you know. We always said that what he did is absolutely wrong, you know, for this world, for himself and for the world. But beyond that, I have no power to. If I have power, I may be able to change. I mean, anything like him, you know, anyone like him. But if I don't have power, then I'm helpless, you know. But I personally, I will never go myself into a negative state, you know, just because of his negative state. Yeah.
That, I think that point about the complexity of cause and effect is a great point, and we encounter it every day in our own lives. I know, you know, like if there's a car accident or something like that, you think, oh, if only I'd left 2 minutes earlier, you know, if only I hadn't, you know, stopped to let the dog out, I wouldn't have had that car accident, you know, and you can very easily assign blame to one event when it's really, of course, not that way at all.
Right.
And then the other sort of mental flipping tool, which I've never thought of in this context before, but is to think, well, maybe by having that fender bender, even though it, you know, cost me thousands of dollars, it actually averted something worse. If I had left 2 minutes before, maybe I would have hit a child in the street, you know, and that never happened because, you know, so it's like, don't get too attached to the cause and effect. And, you know, I don't know, for all I know, the actions of Hitler and Stalin in World War II averted a nuclear catastrophe in 1958, you know, because, you know, I don't know, you know, it would have been a different history. So you can't, you know, don't get too attached to cause and effect or you know, that sort of outcome. But I like your summary point. At least you're not adding more negativity based on the best that you know.
Some days, I don't know why I'm here, doesn't really matter, but some those same days, I feel very much about attachment to cause and effect, but like you said, Jan, maybe that day was about me being you know, the personal, like, okay, I blew it today, and that impacted me, but yes, I also have been abused to something that I helped not happen. Those are something I've thought about. So I love to be in discussion about it with other people's minds.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the right approach is similar to Alex's. You know, you hear these sort of vast ideas of, you know, the Lojong, the mind training teachings, and in all of a lot of Buddhism, it's very vast and immense, and I think it's very necessary that sometimes you just stand back from all of that and you just think about, what am I going to do with myself in the next few hours, in the next few days, or whatever, and you just have to bring it back down. Because I know I went through a distinct period with my Buddhist beliefs and understanding like that, and it was back when I still worked at Ecology. I walked into the office one day and this stuff was all kind of in my mind, and I just thought, you know, I really don't know about a lot of this stuff, like Sonam says, you know, it's so complicated, especially karma and those things. But the thing that makes, so what does make sense to me is to be kind to other people, just as I happen to interact with them. You know, not to go out of my way, you know, not to go save the world, but just as I happen to interact with people, to be kind to them. And for me, in my Buddhist history, that was very satisfying, and for a very long time, I would come back to that, you know. Because it's very hard to make global sense of it all.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a question. It's sort of related to when Laura asked before the break the question. She had a part A. I don't want to interpret your question, but I was feeling it was referring to when you're over, so you have this sort of other person, but what if some of those emotions are, you know, like intense sadness or anger, we talk about injustice or those sorts of things. And sort of, I was sort of hearing, like Sonam, you had said, it's almost like sort of go right over those emotions because you get caught down in them and move to the what you know you should be doing. Is that kind of the, you know, so that general advice that you'd have that versus, you know, I was sort of thinking of the Lojong when I first heard it. I thought you were dealing with your own emotions, but I don't think that's really the point there. It's to take in other people's. And with your own, possibly, so this is a question, is the goal then to move on from that and start to those behaviors that are more positive for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the, versus
yeah.
Confronting or looking at what might cause your problems or, you know, it's almost like when you got that wisdom, a lot of that might fall away. So you're going to go for the wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ultimately, I mean, as far as I little that I understand, you know, because ultimately the wisdom liberates you from samsara. Of course, you have to have bodhicitta, you know, absolutely, for especially in the Mahayana path, you know. But if you neglect wisdom, you know, then your compassion and bodhicitta also gets, like, you know, stained with, you know, all the 8 worldly concerns that we spoke before, you know. It's the wisdom that really purifies them completely, you know. And then it becomes really pure motivation effort. The wisdom, the compassion also becomes true compassion, you know. Or the bodhicitta becomes also true bodhicitta. If there's no wisdom, then, you know, they get entangled with personal, motivations.
Yeah.
Like the 8 worldly concerns that he talks about, you know, gain, loss, pleasure, pain, praise, blame, and favor, and fame, and dishonor. So when you really understand when you really try to understand shunyata or emptiness, that has the potential to purify all these worldly concerns and then ultimately liberate from the cyclic existence. See, that's how we say Buddhadeva has two wings. One is the wing of wisdom, and the other is the wing of compassion. So they just go together, you know, side by side, without neglecting at the cost of the other. So both must be there simultaneously.
So on the subject of wisdom, Sanam, you were talking about emptiness.
Uh-huh.
I'm just wondering, with your training in physics,
uh-huh,
and Western science, is there anything that you could say simply that supports or gives us more insight into emptiness from a, say, a scientific point of view, or are they completely unrelated, or is there any sort of way in which science supports,
mm-hmm,
the wisdom of emptiness?
Yeah, at one level, I think it can support, you know, because science is so reductionist. So reductionist, you know, you just go step by step by step by step by step by step, and then you come down to the lowest level of existence. Now we, as we see, you know, the world we see through our senses at the moment is that so-called the large scale, macroscopic world. Now, then as you go down in scale, you know, you will go down to molecular level, you know, out of which, now if I have this this water, you know, in my cup, you know, then I will, a time comes when I can just see the molecules of the water, you know. Then now people just look into the molecules themselves, and they will say you have two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom, you know. Then what is inside the hydrogen atom, you know, then you go into the atom and you'll find, you know, protons and neutrons. Then what is inside the proton and neutrons, you will see there are quarks and gluons and so on. So ultimately, now at this state of knowledge, we have reached to the level of quarks and gluons, at least for now, you know. Although there are many other theories, we say that strings may be the fundamental constituents of matter, you know. So from that, you know, ultimate constituent, you just build up slowly to the all visible, and then you go to the cosmic scale also. So from a Buddhist perspective, of course, the Shunyata aspect says that, you know, nothing exists independently, you know, on its own. Everything arises dependently. So at least from the physical point of view, I can go up to that level, you know, to the level of quarks, and then I can just build up slowly all other substances that my senses can observe or see, you know, including even at larger scale, the cluster of galaxies. So this is at one level, you know, at physical level I can understand that this is true, you know, but then from the observer point of view, you know, as we said, you know, that there's because in this physical science we don't talk about the observer or the conscious observer. I mean, now that is where Buddhism comes in. You know, Buddhism also says that the subject and object are related. You know, physics doesn't talk about that directly. You know, they say, okay, the object is like this. That we have studied the objects, and we have reached up down to the level of quarks. But what about the subject? You know, I have no idea what the subject means, and nobody talks about the subject. They even try to, what do you call, sometimes, what do you call, deny, or that's the word taboo. You know, what is taboo means? I don't know. This is a taboo, you know, which means you are not supposed to talk about it. But then in Buddhism, you know, that's all we talk about, you know. The subject is all what we are concerned mostly with, because the subject is the one who suffers all the time, you know. Because Buddhism mainly is concerned with the suffering of sentient beings. See? So in order to liberate from suffering, then you have this question of emptiness or shunyata, you know. That's where the real motivation comes, you know, for understanding shunyata, you know, because we see sentient beings suffering all the time, you know, and we don't want them to suffer, right? Suffer. So then what's the cause of suffering? The collision of karma, you know, and how they generate, you know. They generate from misperceptions about reality. Not only the objective reality, but about the subjective reality also, you know. The various mental states that we have and we generate, you know. And therefore, if we now understand how these mental factors come into existence, all the negative emotions that give rise to suffering, how they generate, you know, in the first place, how they are generated or how they come into existence. Now that's how Buddhism analyzes, you know, and ultimately will come to the clinging, you know, to the self-clinging, you know, or self-clinging or attachment, you know. So then Buddhism offers the method to really, annihilate that, you know, to extinguish that self-clinging at its root, you know. And that's where you say, okay, now you can liberate yourself from samsara. So in that sense, from the physical sense, it's very, very much related to shunyata, of course. But at the mental level, they don't talk about, you know, mental shunyata, the shunyata within the consciousness. But the science is concerned about shunyata of external existence, you know, I mean the so-called objective world, you know. But at the quantum level, of course, then the subject and object becomes blurred, and then, you know, we have we may come to Buddhism, you know, sooner or later, the Buddhist approach. Yeah.
I don't know if you want to get more detail on the physics thing, but isn't the idea of a fundamental particle in opposition to the idea of emptiness? If emptiness is the true nature of things, then there's no such thing as a fundamental particle, right?
Yeah, that's true. That is true from the Buddhist perspective,
right.
But then from the physics perspective, they haven't not yet reached that stage. You know?
Right.
Of course, they will now say, okay, we have. They will say that from the vacuum comes all these fields, you know, all the particles emerge from the so-called vacuum, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but we are not sure what the vacuum really is yet, you know, from the physical aspect, you know. Because all the physicists will say now, through they have these theories like quantum field theory, and then they will say that all these ultimately are made of fields, you know,
right,
which emerge from the vacuum, you know, and the
right.
vacuum particles, I mean, the fields go back and come out,
right.
I mean, almost with the speed of light, you know, I mean, that's every moment is happening, you know.
Right.
But then it makes the objective reality because all the fields come and then they form particles and then the particles aggregate, you know, together and make more particles and they aggregate and then we have the large-scale universe, the objective universe that we see through our senses, you know. But our senses themselves are made of those particles in the first place, you know. And so who is who, you know? Who is watching whom, you know? Who is sensing whom? Yeah, I mean, those are questions.
There's at least one physicist, David Bohm, who is a quantum physicist.
Right.
And he talks about the implicate order.
Mm-hmm.
The explicate order is where everything seems multiple.
Mm-hmm.
The implicate order, where there's only one thing, everything is so totally interconnected. They call it quantum entanglement, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the physical situation mirrors the subjective situation,
mm-hmm.
in that there's
right.
Ultimately no division between
mm-hmm.
one thing.
Yes,
and another.
Yes, yes. That's Bohm's attitude, Bohm's idea, right? But he is not accepted by other physicists, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They will not accept as he said, you know. Maybe some accept like what he says, but they may come closer to, you know, if they really investigate the consciousness, you know, the observer aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, you know, this is not done, you know, enough so that we can just turn the table or what, I mean, so that the reality, the whole reality is seen, you know. I mean, the whole reality, they call it sometimes holographic, you know, the holographic reality, involving both subject as well as object, you know, I mean, object as well as subjective, the totality of reality, you know. At the moment, we have objective universe, and then we don't care about what subjective world is. I mean, from the physical science aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe psychology cares about it, you know, in some sense. And then now neuroscience comes, of course, to some extent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The neuroscience will say, of course, it still says, you know, the consciousness is product of brain function, you know. But, yeah, but then there's at least some study going on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is really, whether it's really, I mean, product of brain or whether it can really exist separately, independently, autonomously. But, you know, in Buddhism we say, you know, consciousness has different levels, and the subtlest level of consciousness is independently of, I mean, it can exist independently of the brain, you know. Of course, at the larger macroscopic analysis, the brain works, you know, fine, you know, our consciousness and brain works together. But as you go down subtler levels of consciousness, then it becomes more and more independently of brain, you know. And the subtlest level of consciousness doesn't care about the brain at all, you know. I mean, it can exist independently of brain. And that is how we see, you know, one life, we can have next life and previous life. Because the subtlest level of consciousness is not, you know, dependent on brain. And so if brain dies, the subtlest level of consciousness doesn't die, you know, it can just move to next life. Right.
So are we talking about just all beings? Because at some point of the eons of times,
mm-hmm.
we've all been somebody's mother. And
yes, yes.
So it's all beings.
Yes, all beings, all sentient beings, right.
Oops.
Yes.
So what would be the difference in offering and brief directly or indirectly? In number seven, when you're offering help and happiness to all my mothers directly or indirectly, would you know that you're doing it if it's indirect?
Indirectly?
Indirectly or directly?
Yeah. So yeah, this is what he says. You know, it's really Samaya Dala Lembra Show means. Now this is kind of very advanced practice in a sense. Directly, I can help my mother, you know, because if I am mother, or even if I take all sentient beings as mother, you know, I can give them food if they need food. I give them shelter if they need shelter. Whatever possible way I can help them, you know, in the physical sense directly, or if they need teaching, you know, if I can teach them, you know, how to practice Dharma, also that too is helping them, you know. But indirectly, it's difficult in the sense because unless I have, you know, enough insight, I don't know how my mothers are suffering, what they need, what they want, you know, in what way I can help them, you know. But still, I try to. If someone doesn't accept me directly, my help, then I can help to someone else indirectly. So this is a little bit tricky, I mean, I, as far as I understand, you know. You see, I mean, if my mother doesn't want help directly, you know, at least I cannot help her directly in that sense. But then through other means, you know, through my other friends, through my other community members, or from other sources, I may be able to help, you know, if she's not readily accepting my help. That is another one way of interpreting it, you know. But it can have many other interpretations. See, maybe Gisela will help me, you know, to interpret it more. Or anyone can, you know, help, you know. Yeah. Yeah, this practice especially, you know, because it says Samaya Dala Lembra Shok means, you know, I just take the pain secretly, you know, without knowing my mother, you know. Because if my mother is suffering and not ready to accept that she's suffering, then I'm not able to help her directly, you know. But still, I can help to through the help of other community members, through the help of my other friends and community members or from other sources, in order to get rid of her health, I mean her sickness or her suffering. Yeah.
Would you say that prayers are indirect?
Yeah, yeah, prayers indirectly, of course. Yeah, definitely, it is indirect. You know, I mean, she may not be knowing that I'm praying for her. You know. Yeah.
So Sonam, why is this most subtle level, this most subtle level of consciousness that goes from one life to the next?
Mm-hmm.
So why is that not like a higher self or something that we should identify with as some self, you know, or some higher self?
Okay. Yeah. Because you know the concept of self as is postulated by non-Buddhist is that it is permanent, it is what do you call Takchi Rawanchen, Takwa Chiku Rawanchen. Takwa means it's almost eternal or permanent, yeah, permanent.
Yeah, permanent, yeah.
It is singular Chiku, mm-hmm. one unitary self. Takwa Chiku Rawanchen, and then they say it is independently existing, you know. But the Buddhist concept is that there's nothing independently existing, you know. So it just, what do you call it? While it's the Buddhist principle of Buddhist principle, it says that nothing exists independently on its own. Everything is interdependent. Even that subtle self is changing momentarily. You know,
mm-hmm.
even that subtle self is what do you call it? In some language we call that the vessel. You know, the so-called luminous mind. You know,
mm-hmm.
the luminous mind. You might hear about, it, especially in Vajrayana Buddhism. Geshe-la will elaborate on
yeah.
it more. You know, the concept of luminous mind. That is exactly what it is. You know, in Vajrayana Buddhism, they will call it luminous mind, but otherwise, it is this very self. You know, this the most subtle self.
Hmm. But if it changes,
yeah, that is a very difficult concept. You know,
yeah.
Now for this, I have to understand the whole of you know the Buddhist literature.
If it changes, then what happens?
So if this subtle self, most subtle self,
right.
changes, then why isn't it like a personality, you know? Why isn't it like my true, why isn't it like my true personality if it's influenced by the things that happen in my life?
Why is not my true person? It is no. Suppose I die, you know,
yeah.
and my subtle self, during the time of death, you know, I could identify, you know, if I could identify with my subtlest level of self, then I have a means to intervene, you know, so that I don't go to the next birth. Even you know, I might
mm-hmm.
be able to. Get liberated in this very life,
mm-hmm.
at that very moment of death. And that is all Vajrayana practice, you know, and the Vajrayana techniques are there, you know. But in case, if I'm not able to do that, I'll be reborn somewhere, you know. But still, I carry all my personality, you know, I mean, the karmic personality. Karmic, what do you call?
The karmic influence?
Yeah, the karmic, the whole karmic map, you know, whatever I've done, whatever I've not purified until now. All the remaining karmic influences are, I mean, what do you call influence or predispositions, I don't know what you call that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a sense, it's all the residues of my karma, you know,
mm-hmm.
still there on it. It's like a hard drive, you know, to some extent. Yeah, I mean, to be very crude, you know.
Yeah.
It has all the memory of my past ever since, from times immemorial, you know. Those bad karmic influences that I have not yet purified, you know, they are still there, and all the karmic good influences, they are still also there, you know.
So in
but
this subtle consciousness, there is these I guess sometimes it's called the imprints from
right.
your past.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they're kind of in what do you call? They're just when bears. Hibernate. So
mm-hmm.
all our karmas.
Yeah, all are dormant in a sense.
Hibernating at that time because it is only luminous light, so you cannot be acting or ripening at that moment, but then that luminous mind, subtle mind, has connected to a different life, then we have more consciousness, more perceptions, and then some things trigger us. It's like a PTSD flashbacks. Then we'll have these flashbacks that are triggered by this life's events, and we will then access those. Then those wholesome deeds, the seeds of the wholesome deeds unwholesome may ripen in this life. So it is continuing, but it's important not to call it self. It's not the self that is continuing, but it is the subtlest consciousness that is continuing.
They call it in the form energy, you know. I mean, energy level. That's a difficult concept, of course. Like, if I have electromagnetic energy, you know, in this room, in fact, the whole room is filled with all the channels of the world's electromagnetic radio stations that is, you know, coming to us. But since we don't have the means to capture it, you know, if I have a radio receiver here, then one of the channels I can pick, you know, and then I can just convert it into sound and picture, you know. Something like that, you know, to some extent. I mean, it's a very crude analogy, but something like that, you know. Because as we go from one level of birth to the next level, if it is born in a human being, then the consciousness merges with the egg, you know, the so-called zygote, the mother's egg, the father's sperm mix together, fusion, you know, then a new egg forms, and that is the moment when the subtlest conscious is supposed to be entering, you know. And then it has to develop continuously, slowly, like, you know, for 10 months in the mother's womb, and then comes out, you know, as a human baby after some time. So then the whole life cycle continues like that, you know. But if I have no good karma, I can be in any other life form, you know, out of the six realms. I can be in the animal realm, I can be in the hell realm, or hungry ghost realm, in the deva realm, like that, you know, depending on what karmic constitutions I have in my subtlest level of consciousness.
Right, so spiritual practice is in one sense, you could look at all the spiritual practice as
right.
As purifying that karma.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Is eliminating those
negative
karma.
In a sense, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So my limited understanding is that in this moment, part of my karma is unfolding, but not because of me, but it's the how it unfolds is kind of impacted by all our karmas.
Yeah.
At the same time as this karma energy is unfolding, a new karma energy is being generated that then follows.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not truly mine. So you guys behave, I have nice karma.
Yes, yes. It is both global and individual, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean it's a very
yes.
complicated karma, you know. As we said before, it's a really complicated subject.
Yeah, karma is considered as more complex than emptiness. And
more
so therefore more complex than ultimate reality.
To understand it.
Okay. So there's a whole response to that. The Buddhists respond, if you ask too much karmic questions, if you're thinking too much about cause and result, then the answer is inconceivable. That's the official response. But that doesn't mean that you should not analyze cause and condition and the result. We analyze to some extent where we may able to understand, and then we will reach to a very, very complex cause and condition situation where there is no way to analyze at that time. Then you simply say, now I reach inconceivable state, let me take break. and then focus on what you could do and not like what you cannot do.
So yeah, so the final stage is that, you know, if you really want to get, if you really want to understand what karma is like, then you have to get enlightened, you know. That is the ultimate state. That is why Buddha says only people like myself and maybe the highest bodhisattvas can understand how karma is like, but other ordinary persons cannot understand it, you know.
So let me show you how karma complex is. So sometimes you engage with dharma practice, consider as wholesome deed, right? But while you are doing practice, you may get sick, or you may encounter some loss within you and your relatives and friend, and then what can you say? Is that my result? I practiced dharma, I did this practice, and now I'm experiencing this sickness and the losses, and then what can you say? Is your sickness result of your dharma practice that you just did? So that's why there are many ways how to respond. One is to say that karma is so complex that your dharma practice actually speed up the whatever karmic results that needs to be ripened. So when you engage with some wholesome deeds, actually you look like you are experiencing the result of your unwholesome deeds.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the interpretation is that actually if you do, sometimes you engage more, you do well, you may experience more difficulties, and partly it means that now you are actually processing and speeding up the transformation and purification. So that's the attitude that you need to have, and then still continue and not to be discouraged. So if karma is very, very, so karma is not a concrete, it's never a linear way, it is so complex. If we just talk about this life from childbirth to now, it is so complex. How can we point out that this result is a result of this deeds?
Okay.
So it's a very, very difficult. But we do best, and you analyze certain degree, and you really take break, and then experience whatever is happening. Yes.
I just want to recommend, I found a book by Trelig Kapkyon,
mm-hmm.
It's about karma. The title is Karma,
mm-hmm.
What It Is, What It Isn't, and Why It Matters. It's not a huge book, but it's a really nice, succinct approach to
mm-hmm.
what we're talking about here,
right.
From
mm-hmm.
a teacher.
Right. It is so complex that Abhidhamma Kosha explains many different types of causes, many types of results. There are some results that are directly related to the cause. There are some results that are actually not directly to the current cause, but it is related to something else. So maybe that will be topic for next public talk or something.
Yeah.
We'll come back. We're not avoiding just saying inconceivable.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a question about the subtle consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
To have an intention when you're going through that process,
mm-hmm.
To have an intention to come back with a precious life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, because I don't understand. You, if you're at that, you need to start it well beyond, before
yes.
the
yeah,
intention,
yeah.
well be
yeah, yeah.
before
yeah,
you
yeah.
get to that, the subtleness
mm-hmm.
of that. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Not at that.
No, no. Yeah, one must be already familiar.
If you could. yes, you really do practice. And
yeah.
in some ways, we say all we do now is actually preparing for the final stages of life. So sometimes we are not capable to do it, then we ask someone to read that. And as you go through very, very deep final stages, and then the technique is, because your hearing ability also loses, and because the consciousness actually is kind of reducing from concrete to more subtler. So I have observed this great Sakya scholar and meditator. When someone is actually going through the final stages, this meditator, great scholar, shout very loud from his understanding that as we go final stages, it's really difficult to hear. So because of that, this teacher is saying, recollect your root teacher. Recollect your root teacher now. Like that. People think that this will be disturbed and scared. But who knows? We don't know. What. So either we do it ourselves or ask to do it for someone else. Or you have your own pre-recorded cellphone that will play again. Or you record whatever voice you want to hear and you actually play when we go through final stages.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of techniques these
yeah.
days. You can also play Googles. Just kidding.
You can play our retreat chanting.
There's an app that unless you like disable it, unless you say I'm alive, you know, your phone would automatically start reading to you.
Oh, yeah.
Every day you have to, you know. Not yet. Not dead yet.
Any other questions? Any clarifications? Please ask Sonam.
Yeah, if one wants to just really practice this dying process, then one can you know learn how to do it. First, one has to, get some kind of teachings, you know, from a really experienced guru and get some kind of what do you call lineage, you know. We usually call empowerment or initiation, something like that, you know, to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And if one wants to seriously practice, yeah, then there are really very systematic techniques explained, you know, how to practice this,
mm-hmm.
and get so familiarized, you know, so that at the time of death, you know, there's no problem whatsoever, you know, you just can, you know, directly identify or recognize you're dying, and then at that time, you know, you can now do all the necessary things that you want to do, you know, for the next moment.
But just having that intention through your practice, through your dharma practices all along, is going to
help you, of course. Yeah,
that.
Yeah, help you. But one can still practice even before death, you know. Even now, I can practice the death, the so-called dying process, you know, the systematic resolution that takes place while dying, you know, because then you have so many stages of death, you know. Slowly, at various stages.
I do have a question before we leave the eight verses. So, you know, this isn't being presented to us as part of a practice, like, you know, not chanting it, et cetera, et cetera. It's not in a sadhana or anything. So how does one use, what do you recommend, what should we do? Just occasionally read this and reflect on it, or, you know?
So how about this?
What should we do?
So please look at this and select one verse that resonates to you. If nothing, then it is still okay. So how about you look at this at this moment? We don't know future. But at this moment, which verse or stanza speaks to you that relates to you, if there is one? Do you have one now? So Jackie, how will you read it, yours? Is that okay? Yeah.
Even when someone I've helped or in whom I have placed great hopes mistreats me very unjustly, I will view that person as a true spiritual teacher.
Anyone similar? Like, that is verse 6, right? Do you have a similar, or everyone has a different than 6?
No, I like 6.
So Kim, you like 6, right? At the moment.
Yeah, at the moment.
Yeah, at the moment. We are just moment by moment. Mm-hmm. Okay, no responsibilities beside that. Anyone else want to read your whatever verse that speaks to you? Do you have one?
I do. Right now I like number 3. In every action I will watch my mind. In the moment destructive emotions arise, I will confront them strongly and avert them, since they will hurt both me and others. I think this last couple of days has helped me visualize this verse a little more clearly.
Anyone else? Yes.
Oh, I was with number 3.
Number 3. How many of you number 3 at the moment? Okay. So lots of number 3.
Lots of 3s, yeah.
Okay. Any other numbers that you...
That I'm 4. Right?
Number 4. Can you read that for us?
So that's... this is a challenging one for me, but that's why it's speaking to me. Whenever I see ill-natured beings or those overwhelmed by heavy misdeeds or suffering, I will cherish them as something rare, as though I'd found a priceless treasure.
Okay, how many of you chose number 4? Anyone? Anyone? Okay. Any other numbers? Yes?
I sort of have a jump, a cascade. I like...
Which number?
Like... One, kay. By thinking of all sentient beings, even just I think that sentence, just thinking of all sentient beings, and then maybe just precious, and I will always hold them dear. You know, 2, from the depths of my heart, cherish others. I will watch my mind. 3 is the strongest one for the whole thing. In my every action, I will watch my mind, and the moment destructive emotions arise, I will confront them strongly and avert them, since they hurt both me and others. And that the ill-natured beings and the overwhelmed beings by heavy misdeeds, cherishing them, and then the people out of envy that do me wrong, somehow give them the okayness rather than me, like they shouldn't have done that to me. And mistreating from someone I felt. So just, I will offer help and happiness. So saying in brief, it's wonderful to say in brief, from all of that.
So how many verses, sorry?
I just don't know what the eight worldly concerns are because I wasn't here yesterday. So.
Did you read all of them? Did you read all, all the eight verses?
Yeah, all the way through them.
Okay.
But that's what I'm saying is that
I
sort of hop a little bit.
I see.
With my eyes, I can hop.
I see.
And
then
I'm not saying each verse, I'm encompassing
right.
the whole thing.
I see.
When I hop.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And that is what you can do. You can also select.
But I think three,
combine.
Focus the most.
Three?
Three.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Any other three? Number three. Grace above you.
Sounds good.
Okay. Number three?
Yeah.
Okay. And anyone?
Number eight.
Number eight?
Yeah.
Can you read number eight for us, please?
I will learn to keep all these practices untainted by thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. May I recognize all things as like illusions and without attachment gain freedom from bondage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the answer for James' question is you select which verse, which concept teaching speaks for you, and you pick up that and you read and you recite, and if possible you create your melody and sing.
Mm-hmm.
Sing it while you wash your dish or while you walk, while you in the forest, and that's how I learned from Kenpo Abe Rinpoche that you recite like a song and it's easier to memorize. Okay. At the same time you are really enjoying.
I mean, it seems to me that one of the ways I'm excited about using this list is to take a moment to think about which of these verses in this moment would be the most beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
And I can imagine changing very regularly.
Yeah.
I mean, in this heavy political season, I'm very much locked into number four at times.
Yeah.
You know, because I all those passions
mm-hmm.
come up in me and I start
mm-hmm.
to have, you know, those. And at other times, like right now, when I've been talking about emotions and how we want to be with those emotions, three makes sense. I think it would be beneficial just to pick this up on a daily basis and say, oh, this is the one I need to hold to right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
you
can make eight songs.
Yeah, I'm
yes.
going to be a big songwriter.
And also, you don't necessarily need to recite exactly out of your own experience. You write your Lojong saying slogans. You may have just one sentence, but all of these are used as a kind of reminder, and of course all of these verses carry so many meaning. That's why these are called a root text, and root texts are the outline for many, many essential meanings. Okay, so with that, how about we put them into practice? So my goal is to put them into practice, integrate, and we'll have a guided instruction. First, we do our breathing like we did yesterday morning. And so we'll do this deep breathing of breathing in, holding, and releasing it. And then we'll do Tonglen practice, which will summarize all the Lojong practices, especially verse number 7. Okay. All right, so let's first do our foundation practice. Grounding, stabilizing our body and mind through deep breathing exercise. So let us breathe in, breathe down to our abdomen, and hold and release. Let's do it again. Breathe in through our nostril. Breathe down towards abdomen. And hold. And release. Let's do it the third time. Breathe in through your nostril, down to your abdomen, and hold, and release. This time, we will practice counting breathing. So this time, you focus on your natural breathing without breathing deeply or shallow, whatever is your natural breathing. So let's focus on our natural breathing, being aware of breathing in and breathing out. And let's start focusing on counting our breathing. Bringing attention on counting your breathing, inhale and exhale. Let us start the actual practice of Tonglen. Then choose someone as a focus for the Tonglen meditation. It could be a loved one, especially someone who is going through a difficult time, or you could choose a group of people displaced from their war-torn home and struggling to get by in a crammed refugee camp, for instance. So choose your object of Tonglen practice at this time. Now contemplate, just like me, they too wish to overcome suffering. Just like me, they too wish to overcome suffering. On the basis of this recognition, generate a sense of concern for their well-being and the wish that they be free of pain, fear, and sorrow. With this compassionate wish, mention that their pain, fear, and sorrow emerge from their bodies in the form of dark clouds that enter your body. As you breathe in, they dissolve into a radiance of light at your heart. Where they are completely extinguished. Imagine that as a result of your taking away their suffering, they become free from pain, fear, and sorrow. While thinking of them, reinforce the thought, just like me, they too aspire to happiness. Just like me, they too aspire to happiness. On the basis of this recognition, generate the wish that they find peace and joy. As you cultivate these caring thoughts for them, and as you breathe out, imagine sending white clouds and lights, rays from your heart that touch them, bringing them your compassion, your joys, your good fortune, and everything that is good in you. Imagine that they find peace, strength, and happiness. Repeat this alternating practice of taking in pain, fear, and sorrow, and sending out peace and joy. So let me repeat Thonglin practice. Just like me, they too wish to overcome suffering. Just like me, they too wish to overcome suffering. On the basis of this recognition, generate a sense of concern for their well-being and the wish that they be free of pain, fear, and sorrow. With this compassionate wish, imagine that their pain, fear, and sorrow emerge from their bodies in the form of dark clouds that enter your body. As you breathe in, they dissolve into a radiant of light at your heart. where they are completely extinguished. Imagine that as a result of your taking away their suffering, they become free from pain, fear, and sorrow. While thinking of them, reinforce the thought, just like me, they too aspire to happiness. Just like me, they too aspire to happiness. On the basis of this recognition, generate the wish that they find peace and joy. As you cultivate these caring thoughts for them, and as you breathe out, imagine sending white clouds and light rays from your heart that touch them, bringing them your compassion, your joys, your good fortune, and everything that is good in you. Imagine that they find peace, strength, and happiness. Now, try to see if you can make this taking in and sending out bigger. Say if you have just done Tonglen for a loved one who is going through a difficult time, extend it to many others who might be in a similar situation. Take in and send out. As you breathe in, you are taking in the unwanted causes and results of others. And as you breathe out, you are sending out all the positive cause and results. You could even extend Tonglen to individuals whom you consider difficult, those who wish you ill and have treated you unfairly. Contemplate that they too, just like you, do not wish to suffer. They too just wish to be happy and have peace. Finally, if your heart feels big, extend Tonglen to all beings. Imagine taking away the pain and fear and sorrow of all beings, sending to them your loving kindness and compassion. And now remain in silence with this thought for a little while, until you hear more instruction. session whenever you feel ready.